Hi, I'm Taro Nettleton. I'm at the Program in Visual and Cultural Studies at the University of Rochester. And so I'll be presenting my paper, An Adult is Being Beaten, Infantility, Development, and Power in Shuji Terayama's Emperor Tomato Ketchup. And I just want to give, I want to say two things. One is that I'm very grateful for this opportunity to present this paper here, and it's the first time that I've done so. And also, I will be showing a clip that involves small children in sexual situations, or in a sexual situation. So if that's unbearable to you, then you should not be here, I guess. Okay. All right. Barring Kenneth Anger's Scorpio Rising, there may not be a campier film that evokes the aesthetics of fascism than Shuji Terayama's Emperor Tomato Ketchup from 1970. The film casts 70 nameless children as fascists who serve the emperor, who is always dressed in Napoleonic garb. Here's a picture of Shuji Terayama, the director of the film, with on the set of Emperor Tomato Ketchup. The small boy laughing in the background is the emperor. And here he's seen dressed up and ruling over adults in the image on the right. This is an adult man shining his shoes. Well, actually, in this shot, there's a voiceover that narrates that the father shall shine the child's shoes and the mother shall play the violin for her son. So, and so the emperor has imprisoned all adults, and he's governing the land with an iron fist. The film is thus an oblique representation of Japan's fascist and colonialist behavior during the Asia-Pacific War, albeit this time recast with children. The film is shot in black and white, 16 millimeter, primarily with a handheld camera, and like many low-budget experimental films, the shots tend to be short and without synced sound. And although Terayama is one of Japan's most widely known experimental filmmakers, Terayama is best known for his theatrical activities. In 1967, he established his troupe Tenjo Sajiki. And on the right here, you see a poster for one of their plays, 1001 Nights in Shinjuku from 1968. and Terayama claimed that the members of Tenjo Sajiki were comprised primarily by young runaways who had arrived unexpectedly at his doorstep. These runaways were a product, at least in part, we assume, of a series of essays in which Terayama encouraged teens and young adults to run away from home. Here is an LP put out by Tenjo Sajiki called Baramon, or Gate of Roses, from 1973. And here a collection of essays entitled Iede no Susume, which is a guide for running away from home. So it's quite obvious, literal. Originally published in 1972. So Emperor Tomato Ketchup continues Terayama's lifelong critique of the family structures, or the family structure and interrogations of origins and teleology. And as a part of this, he constantly revised his personal biography as well. Emperor Tomato Ketchup might also be considered the perverse sister film to Nagisa Oshima's In the Realm of the Senses from 1976. Because while Senses remains Japan's most notorious art film, it nevertheless could not be screened in full in Japan until nearly two decades after its release due to its depiction of adult genitalia and seemingly real intercourse. Emperor Tomato Ketchup, on the other hand, is rarely seen outside of Japan due to its simulated sex scenes, mostly between male children and adult women. Now, this containment of the film inside Japan produces an idea about an inside and an outside, which echoes the representation of space within the film, which is similarly divided into public and private space. And in the film, the outside is a specifically urban space and shown explicitly as a place of discipline, while the private interior spaces are represented primarily as spaces of anti-familial and perverse pleasure. Can we show the first clip? Thank you. So here the small fascists enter a room in which Tenjo Sajiki is performing, basically. That's great, thank you. Okay, so every open door in the film seems to reveal another perversion, while out in the streets, children hunt down adults, just like the Gestapo. Yet if the fantastic connection between fascism and sexuality, which Susan Sontag identified in 1974 as in part a result of the predilections of fascist leaders in themselves for sexual metaphors, that is, that leadership is regarded as sexual mastery of the feminine masses as rape, then the fascist leaders of Emperor Tomato Ketchup certainly fall short of this framework. While the film's most shocking scenes show young prepubescent boys frolicking in an orgy scenario with multiple adult women, there's no mastery performed in these scenes. If anything, these scenes resemble the kind of the placid playfulness of the orgy scenes in Jack Smith's Flaming Creatures. Okay, and can we show the second clip? That's good. Thanks. So today there exists two versions of the film, the original version and one re-edited from the same footage. And while neither version follows a conventional narrative structure, the shorter, more widely seen version is more closely modeled after the surrealist films in its juxtaposition of scenes which lack an organizing thread And it's on this version which I focus my analysis. And in the absence of a clear narrative, the only recurring element that ties the revised film together is the striking visuals of fascistic children. This is kind of a typical sequence of shots in Emperor Tomato Ketchup. So in the first shot, the children play ping pong with a tied up adult woman as a net. And then an adult man falls down the stairs, and then a shot of an old woman being forced to ride some kind of bicycle sculpture at gunpoint. And so what we see recurring is these images of children. Okay. So the film's lack of a narrative is representative of Terayama's desire to critique the teleological development that was ascribed to Japan from the West. The critique is thus much more effectively articulated in the revised version of the film, I believe, which lacks a voiceover narrative, which is used in the original version to give temporal structure to the film. So the re-edited Emperor Tomato Ketchup privileges the juxtaposition of space created through jump cuts over the sequential unfolding of time. And the primacy of space within the film also points to the fact that space and time are inseparable when considering Japan's relation to modernization. As critic Sakai Naoki has pointed out, pre-modern, modern, postmodern may suggest an order of chronology. However, it must be added that this order has never been disassociated from geopolitical configurations of the world. As modernity is always received from the West, within the narrative of modernization, Japan is perennially seen as primitive or infantile, forever fixed in a state of belatedness. And as a self-consciously transgressive film, which also shows golden showers and the beheading of chickens, and inner titles giving viewers instructions on how to correctly pronounce the Japanese slang for female genitalia, the film's shock value is perhaps obvious. However, as film scholar Eric Kasdan suggests in regard to Oshima's In the Realm of the Senses, the effect of exclusively focusing on these bodily spectacles is to, quote, crowd out its relations among elements in the mise-en-scene, relations to history and social relations of power. So my contention is that this film is best understood as a response to the complex web of infantility, power, and ideology which structured the relationship between Japan and the U.S. in the post-war period. The film opens up a framework through which to understand Japan in the post-war era, which had officially been declared over with the Tokyo Olympics in 1964, 6 years prior to the film's release. As Terayama imagined it, the background story of the film was as follows. A child is beaten by his father for not doing his homework. Although the child would normally have turned around and cried at his desk, on this day the boy turned around and stabbed his father to death. The incident triggers a rebellion among all children. This narrative of the film is derived from a radio play entitled The Parent Hunt, which Terayama wrote in 1960. Now, both in 1960, the year the original play was broadcast, and in 1970, when the film was released, the U.S.-Japan Security Treaty was ratified. The treaty guaranteed the continued existence of U.S. military bases in Japan to, quote, contribute to the security of Japan and the maintenance of the international peace and security in the Far East. Now, political demonstrations held over the signing of this controversial treaty, which many felt compromised Japan's independence and involved it in the U.S.'s own neo-colonialist agendas and for the Cold War, produced a mortal casualty for the first time in 1960. So here are shots of demonstrations and at the Diet Building on the right. And Michiko Kamba, the Tokyo University student and first mortal casualty of the Security Treaty demonstrations. So it was within such a period of political turmoil that Terayama wrote this controversial radio play in which children staged the coup d'etat, imprisoning all adults. The radio play was broadcast as a mock news report in the style of Orson Welles' War of the Worlds and received, perhaps understandably, with significant alarm. Authorities in Fukuoka Prefecture, where the program was produced, accused the play of inciting revolt and violence. And given the aforementioned context of that year, it may have been more accurate to claim that the film added to the revolt and violence which had already occurred. Following this decision against the radio play, Terayama was taken in for questioning by the authorities. Although the cautiousness of the authorities was perhaps not unwarranted given this climate of the period, Terayama felt betrayed and enraged by the radio station executive's apology to these authorities, which he saw as an act of sycophancy. In response to their actions, he accused those in power of being children themselves, stating that the play was merely, quote, a magnification of the infantility that underlies all political powers, regardless of ideological positioning, end quote. Now, while Terayama's response denies any difference between ideological positions, insofar as infantility is concerned, the concept of infantility had a particularly important role in defining the relationship after World War II between U.S. and Japan. The ratification of the Security Treaty and the occupation which preceded it were designed to position Japan as a child and student to the U.S.'s father and teacher. The casting of children in Emperor Tomato Ketchup is therefore a critical response to this positioning prescribed to Japan, and the film is also a parodic self-representation of, quote, the Japanese as envisioned in the dominant U.S. perspective. Now, Terayama noted that the original version was initially screened as part of a double bill with a Godard film at Sogetsu. He explained that he felt quite confident about the film at the time, but it was very unpopular. I cut a little more and a little more, and finally a film that was over 2 hours long was now only about 40 minutes long. This gradual shrinking of the film, as described by Terayama, importantly parallels his own shrinking of Japanese adults to children, and maybe more crucially, the fate of Emperor Hirohito in the post-war period, who seemed to have shrunk miraculously from a god to a man to a tiny man, and then to a child who is towered over by General MacArthur in what cultural critic Yoshikuni Igarashi has called their wedding photo. So this shrinking movement, which motivates the imaginary of the film and yet is excluded from its scenes, that is, the children have always already been children within that diegesis of the film, but they represent the past of Japan's adult fascists. So this shrinking movement best critiques the teleological thrust of capitalist democracy imposed onto Japan from outside, like the family unit, which Terayama despised for being imposed onto the child. Paradoxically, it's this shrinking of the emperor's body caused by his partnership with MacArthur, which was forged to continue the role of the emperor as the father of Japan, which this, in effect, would come to symbolize the entire nation of Japan, and leading MacArthur to famously comment that Japan was a nation of 12-year-olds. According to Pulitzer Prize-winning historian John Dower, for Anglo-Americans during World War II, the Japanese were, quote, to be understood in terms of primitivism, childishness, and collective mental and emotional deficiency. And the Japanese, as it turned out, could be understood in much the same way in the post-war period as well, albeit with few changes. Quote, to the victors, the simian became a pet, the child a pupil, the madman a patient. As Dower has explored in detail, Japan's supposed childishness was widely and unquestioningly accepted during the war. Importantly, wartime propagandists were not, as one might expect, the only ones to accept and propagate images of an infantile Japan. Numerous respected academics and specialists, including Margaret Mead, used this image to reinforce, through their academic prestige and scientific know-how, long-standing stereotypes about the Japanese. In an essay that explores the feminization of Japan in Western discourse, Trace Yamamoto has explained that, quote, what's most significant here is that exoticization, dehistoricization, and infantilization all occur at the site of the small Japanese body. The perceived smallness of the Japanese physical being, quote, legitimizes their infantilization as, quote, natural. The enduring Western obsession with the smallness of the Japanese can be traced all the way back to Lafcadio Hearn, who wrote Kwaidan, who also wrote in 1891, that in Japan, he said, or he wrote, elfish everything seems, for everything as well as everybody is small and queer and mysterious. The illusion is only broken by the occasional passing of a tall foreigner. So the same infantility was later used to explain Japan's fascist behavior during the Pacific War. Oh, and actually, I might add that this kind of thinking still exists today. If you've ever seen the film Lost in Translation, one of the big jokes is how small the Japanese are. So according to official post-war discourse, Japan's fascist past was thus a childish aberration, a phase of experimentation that American re-education would bring Japan out of. Not surprisingly, then, Dauer writes, that this temper tantrum explanation of the Japanese violence, which had been offered by Jeffrey Gore and Lester Embry in their national character study, proved extremely attractive to those who engaged in popular psychologizing about the Japanese. As Freud wrote, psychoanalytically speaking, cruelty in general comes easily to the childish nature. So the image of infantility functions fetishistically, allowing the U.S. to see Japan as both a dangerous enemy, which it felt enough animosity towards to deploy an atom bomb, and narcissistically as the best pupil of capitalist democracy. This suggests that within a period of months, U.S. policymakers were able to dramatically shift their view of Japan. In the first instance, Japan is seen as being so utterly other that the thermonuclear bombing of its citizens could be justified as a humanistic act, which requires the conviction that the Japanese are precisely not human. And in the second, the Japanese completely lack any otherness, functioning as a mirror to the U.S., providing it with a sense of self-recognition. So with Emperor Tomato Ketchup, Terayama took this idea of the Japanese smallness to task, not by refuting the image, but by exaggerating it to the point of absurdity by casting actual children in his film. Terayama parodies the literal, and it must be said, idiotic reading of the perceived smallness of the Japanese body as evidence of their childishness by taking Wilhelm Reich's words that the fascist mentality is the mentality of the little man, seemingly at face value. Here we see little fascists dragging an old man by the neck. Emperor Tomato Ketchup. By playing out this Western fantasy of Japanese infantility in moving images, he makes strange all of the monstrous discourse which incessantly infantilizes Japan. Although Terayama's own research in psychoanalysis was more focused on the works of Reich than Freud, the film opens with a scene bearing a striking likeness to the title of Freud's famous essay on masochism in children, A Child is Being Beaten. The scene shows a group of boys who stand looking in from outside a room, inside which a girl is being spanked by what looks to be her mother. Now, being that this is a Terayama film, the father who holds the girl is in drag. And can we show the third clip? That's good, thank you. So Freud notes that this common fantasy is experienced in three stages. In the initial phase, a child fantasizes that the paternal figure is beating another child, which is experienced as proof of the father's love for the child who's doing the fantasizing. However, after an actual beating takes place, the child learns to feel both ashamed for his desire for the paternal figure and to convert the pain of being beaten into, oops, I lost my place. After an actual beating takes place, the child learns to feel both ashamed for its desire for the paternal figure and to convert the pain of being beaten into masochistic pleasure. So if this scene is read as an allegory for Japan and its relation to the paternal figure of the U.S., the two stages, I would suggest, take place in reverse. And I don't have any intention of belittling the seriousness of the atrocity, but this reading suggests that the dropping of the atom bomb was the biggest spanking that Japan received from the U.S., and not that Japan ever learned to see that as a pleasurable experience, but it did effectively awaken a love for the U.S. which was prohibited during the war. So for a Japanese audience, The film's title, Emperor Tomato Ketchup, would have signified at least two parallel but separate meanings. In the first, ketchup, considered a quintessentially American food, is used to describe the emperor. The first connotation suggests that the emperor, considered the patriarch of the family of Japanese citizens, is tainted by Americanness. Such an image might be taken as a critique of the enthusiasm and velocity with which Hirohito turned from a divine leader to the crusade, divine leader of the crusade against Western imperialism, to an acolyte of American culture and lifestyle. While during World War II, many English words such as baseball and soccer were deemed words of the enemy nation and banned, the emperor wholly embodied American ideopolitical positioning immediately following Japan's surrender. In exchange, Emperor Hirohito was exempted from the Tokyo trial held to establish war responsibility. And as Yoshikuni Igarashi argues, by 1947, Hirohito ventriloquized the United States' desire as his own, rearticulating the U.S. policy in East Asia as Japan's own security concern. This obviously is not 1947, but so such a context significantly complicates the film by adding a dimension of self-critique regarding Japan's own role in the Pacific War. By becoming a follower of American policy, the emperor was able to repress his own involvement in the war and aggressions against other Asian nations, thereby giving credibility to the story that he was a mere puppet figure manipulated by the Japanese military. The film's depiction of a fascist Japan motivates the return of this repressed past and challenges its Japanese audience to come to terms with it. And ketchup also at the same time represents children, as its sugary flavor is commonly understood in Japan to be one favored by children. Here, the childishness of the ketchup is also taken as an attribute of Americanness. As in Japanese, ketchup has no translation. Thus exploding the strictly delineated relationship of the American adult model to Japanese child student. Terayama deflates the attribution of childishness to Japan by pointing to the childlike quality of ketchup, this American condiment, by implying that infantility is in fact a characteristic of the U.S. and applied to Japan from the same. Preeminent cultural critic Akira Asada gives an outline of how the process of infantilization is directly connected to the establishment of a capitalist system and concurrent narrative of teleological modernization. He argues that for modernists, the formation of the subject of industrial capitalism, quote, who bears responsibility for himself, is the indispensable condition for Japan's modernization. If we call this subject the adult, modernization is precisely the process of maturation. While I don't intend to argue that Japan's modernization started after 1945, the debate on how such a subject should be formed did explode in the post-war period amongst many Japanese intellectuals on the left. Moreover, the U.S. did see its mission as one in which the Japanese, a nation of 12-year-olds, would be brought up quickly into subjects of capitalist democracy. By 1960, Japan was well into its period of miraculous growth, and as touched upon in my introduction, the Olympics signaled the end of the post-war period. These landmark events seemed to show that Japan was successfully moving along the path to maturity. However, as Eric Kasdan notes, the 1970s were a period of crisis for Japan on many levels. The year 1970 and the automatic renewal of the Japan-U.S. Security Treaty was seen as a sign of failure and consequently fragmented the left into warring factions. The oil crisis in the middle of the decade forced Japan to turn its productive focus on consumer goods. And many of the major film studios experienced severe decline. A product of a period experienced as a crisis for Japan, Emperor Tomato Ketchup is a historiographical project, which attempts to reorganize dominant representations of Japan's role in the Pacific War and its relationship to the U.S. in the post-war period against the culturally dominant evacuation of this history as a past to overcome and to forget. With Emperor Tomato Ketchup, Terayama critically engaged with the U.S. psychologizing narrative of Japan's infantility and linear progress to produce what Mary Louise Pratt has termed an autoethnographic text. As Pratt explains, autoethnography involves a strategic appropriation or a collaboration with the dominant representation or narrative. Thus, it's not what, quote, one usually thinks of as authentic or autonomous forms of self-representation. Terayama works from within the myth of Japanese infantility to deconstruct its logic. He refuses to construct his film as an autonomous self-representation because he understands that myths and stereotypes can't be undone through oppositional means. And more importantly, he's well aware that self-representation can never be autonomous. And to underscore this impossibility, Terayama appropriates two audio recordings to frame the film. The first, presented along with the intertitles explaining the constitution of the land represented in the film, is Emperor Hirohito's notoriously obtuse announcement of Japan's surrender, broadcast to the nation via radio on August 15, 1945. As is well known, this broadcast of the emperor's speech was an unprecedented event, constituting a veritable coming out for the emperor, who had hitherto been considered a living god, and he came out as a mere man. The event was structured by a central contradiction. Ironically, it was the disembodied transmission of Hirohito's voice that announced his embodiedness as a man. Accentuating the use of appropriated audio in the film are the numerous shots of the Victorola, his master's voice statue, seen in these three images that I've put up. So this image of a dog listening carefully to his master's voice at once harkens to the radio broadcast of Hirohito's voice accepting defeat and to the fervor with which the Japanese accepted the new democratic lifestyle in the aftermath of the war. The two reference point to the dual meanings of fidelity represented by the Victorola image, accuracy and loyalty. The second audio recording taken from the opening ceremony of the 1964 Olympics, or more specifically from Kon Ichikawa's film of the event, Tokyo Olympiad, is used in the final scene of the film. The audio track is superimposed over a shot of the three children dressed up as the rulers of nations, including the Emperor Tomato Ketchup, shown lined up as they would be to watch the opening ceremony of the Olympic Games. As they watch, they try on and trade different glue-on mustaches. Clearly, the mustache represents the idea of maturation, which the Olympics bestowed onto Japan. In fact, one could argue that the Tokyo Olympics is Japan's mustache, performatively entering Japan into adulthood within a Western matrix. By showing that the difference between the fascist Emperor Tomato Ketchup and the mature capitalist emperor is a mere glue-on mustache, Terayama critiques the concept of teleology of modernization and progress. Furthermore, the film decenters the U.S. from Japan's post-war discourse by dwelling not on the dropping of the bomb, but on Japan's actions prior to the bomb. Shifting our focus in such a way sheds light on the origins of the image of the child in the film, which harkens back to the ubiquitous homeless street children who were abandoned and treated as incorrigible delinquents for occupying and being visible in Tokyo's public spaces in the immediate post-war period. It's difficult not to see the fascist children policing the streets of Tokyo as a return of the repressed, these neglected children who were taken to, quote, detention centers that were usually militaristically authoritarian with physical abuse not uncommon. Some boys were even kept naked to prevent them from attempting to escape. Perhaps the full meaning of this repression was unrecognized until triggered by the scenes of youth protesting en masse in the 1960s. This unintelligibility echoes the sexual experience of the children depicted in the film, which, like the film itself, takes on its full significance through deferred action. Thank you.
It's interesting to see you put this in a Japanese context. I wonder if there's any connections to international developments that sort of expound upon some of these themes. Mm-hmm. There were American movies made at the time that enacted this exact same scenario of youth sort of taking over and establishing a semi-fascistic state. And I wonder if there's themes enacted in this film that are consistent with this idea internationally of a kind of insurgent revolutionary youth culture that, I don't know. I'm just curious as to whether you could talk about
well,
that.
Well, I guess I can and I can't because I don't know the specific films that you're referring to, but I think the specificity of this film, you know, comes from the fact that it's dealing specifically with Japan's fascist past and the the explanation of that event as being a childish aberration, you know. So it's not a utopian image of, like, children ruling the land. So it's not really revolutionary in the good sense. I mean, it's a fascist revolution. So I think it's a little bit more complicated than this kind of, like, youth in revolt theme. And I think that's what makes it a little bit more interesting, in a sense, for me. But...
One more question? All right, thank you.